It is Tuesday afternoon at 3:30, and joining us is Mr. Peter Buffett. Hi, Peter.
I am here. Hello, Jimmy.
So we survived Black Friday.
We did.
We survived Cyber Monday.
Oh, yes.
And today is Giving Tuesday.
Giving Tuesday.
And that one I can get on board with.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I'm not quite sure why it's just a day, but okay. I'm with you.
It gives me hope, by the way, that there is a Giving Tuesday.
Yeah.
There's an acknowledgement of sort of a counterpoint to the other two things.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And that people participate is such a great thing. Such great, great organizations locally, too, who deserve support.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
We are in the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club.
We are.
We're up to chapter 9.
Wow.
Yeah. Headed into a fairly short chapter with a kind of a compelling title. It's called Intentional Waste.
Yeah. I'm excited to hear this chapter. I've obviously read it, but now I get to hear it in Sean's voice, and we'll see what it's all about.
Chapter 9, Intentional Waste. Intentional waste is the deliberate destruction of goods, or the production of goods and events which use up a lot of labour, but are of no practical value. It has been widely practised in traditional societies, and, in some form, in most societies, with the partial but significant exception of our own. Fertile ecologies have one big problem in common. They are too productive for their own good. Surplus is produced that, unless checked, managed, destroyed or removed, will eventually destroy the system. Lakes can become so rich with life that they die. Many forests rely on periodic fire to clear out their choking abundance. The spruce fir forests of North America, left undisturbed for long enough, become so richly and closely entwined that the birds can't get to the spruce budworm, which, left to breed in peace, will, in due course, destroy the forest. Human societies, too, have been extraordinarily productive. The more successful they are, the more capital they accumulate. You will remember that there are 6 forms of capital, and now we will consider each of these with regard to another distinction, that between foundation capital and growth capital. Foundation capital is the ecological context on which the community depends. Chiefly soil, water, and climate, and the information contained in various forms, tradition, identity, and, literally, DNA. If that information is not conserved, the consequences will ripple out in the form of the permanent loss of species, cultures, and ecosystems. This is capital that needs to be protected at all costs. Growth capital, on the other hand, needs to be limited. For its growth, rising numbers of people, cattle, technology, machines, produces more growth. This is the intensification of the intermediate economy, and unless its growth is constrained, it will become ever more expensive to maintain, while its swelling numbers and the demands it makes on the ecology will, in due course, erode and ultimately destroy the foundation capital. All 6 forms of capital have some part to play, as both foundation capital and growth capital, but there are big differences of emphasis. Let's consider each of the 6 in turn. Natural capital is the condition on which all other capital depends. It would be reasonable to argue that this is the only form of capital which can justifiably be called foundation capital. But surviving the future takes a cautiously broader view, recognizing that, for a human ecology, some broader foundations are needed. Human capital is foundation capital in terms of its capabilities, the talent, insight, emotional qualities, and so forth that make a society. Growth is enabled by human capital in this sense. Yet the multiplication of the number of people among whom such capabilities are duplicated is growth capital. The fuzzy boundaries, overlaps, and dependencies between the two kinds are, of course, acknowledged. Growth is driven by human capital in this sense, large numbers of people applying their capabilities to do work, much of which involves drawing on, or actually reducing, natural capital. Social capital, similarly, is foundation capital that can become a driver of dangerous growth as a society's population increases and its reach extends. Scientific or cultural capital can also be seen as foundation capital. Every society, no matter how small, needs its culture. Scientific knowledge can deepen quality without producing growth. Even technical knowledge can be innocent of any growth program. There is no essential, as distinct from economic, reason why technical advance should produce growth either in GDP or in environmental impact. And technical knowledge can be merely decorative. The East Anglian Traction Engine Society has lots of it. And yet, the reasonable presumption is that such technical knowledge is of a kind which is indeed part of the growth problem. Technical capital clearly implies growth. If we know how to do it, we will do it. This sequence from knowledge to action is regrettable, leading to technologies such as genetic engineering, nanotechnology, and nuclear energy, which we would be well advised to forego. But it is hard to stop. Material capital. Any human society will have at least basic equipment and housing, which could, on some interpretations, be recognized as foundation capital. It is consistent with maintaining the foundations of a social order, rather than building on them without limit. But the extended range of manufacturing, plant, and equipment consists of growth capital. And finally, financial capital. Here we must remember the double counting problem, that money is only a representation of the other forms of capital. Money is not, therefore, included in this distinction between foundation capital and growth capital. Now, like natural systems, resilient societies are as meticulous about limiting or destroying growth capital as they are about conserving foundation capital. And they do so in one or more of three ways. By preventing its growth, by destroying it or discarding it following growth, or by ensuring that whatever it produces, its output does not take the form of further growth capital. That is, let it produce only useless ornaments or extravagant labor-intensive carnivals. Let it be wasted. For then its impact on foundation capital is zero or minimal, in comparison to its impact if it did something useful, such as building machine tools or motorways, training construction engineers, or making productive investments that produced more growth. If growth capital is allowed to accumulate unchecked, it will produce more than can be recycled, reused, or otherwise contained in a closed-loop, self-sufficient system, and the system will, in due course, break down. However, if part of that capital is intentionally discarded in sufficient quantity, or used up in carnival and play, folly and fun, this will reduce production to a level at which it can be kept within the limits of a closed-loop system, making it possible that the ecosystem or community will endure. Waste reduction has a key place with respect to foundation capital, for soil fertility and some scarce materials have to be conserved. Ideally, what is waste to one part of the system should be a valuable input for another. But the central economic ethic is not about reducing waste in all its forms. It is about sustaining, or if necessary, increasing it in some of its forms, acknowledging growth capital as having lethal potential, and thus wasting it, managing it, using it for decoration and delight, or destroying it. In response to this, whether by understanding, instinct, or accident, former societies have devised many ways of getting rid of excess. Weapons, jewels, artifacts, even ships would be deposited in the grave of a chief. Traditional societies organized an endless series of little crashes, creative destruction moments. A frequent event would be the potlatch. The word is from the Chinook language of the Pacific Northwest coast of America, but the practice is widely present. This was a competitive ceremony of mutually assured destruction, in which each contestant would have to more than match his opponent's sacrifice of his own possessions, often by burning, to the point of material devastation for the property of both. In this same profligate tradition, the Egyptians built more pyramids than there were pharaohs to bury in them, and the Florentines and Venetians of the Renaissance spent in abundance on churches, paintings, and carnivals. But it was not only about sacrifice. When gifts are given, something comes back. As the anthropologist Marcel Mauss writes, Gifts to humans and to the gods also serve the purpose of buying peace between them both. This is contract making. There is a gift, there is the obligation to reciprocate, and the imbalance between what is given and what is received can be rather large. Whereas God gives the gift of life and the whole world, all he gets back is a mere cathedral. Mauss summarizes, "Those gods who give and return gifts are there to give a considerable thing in place of a small one." The medieval cathedrals and the astonishing churches, big works of art in little villages, used up the excess wealth, which is the curse of a stable society. Cultures have, to a large extent, been organized around the task of finding celebratory ways of destroying this accursed share, as George Bataille describes it, the capital which would otherwise endow resilient societies with the curse of growth. It can be a process of the utmost decorum. A modern demonstration of an ancient version of this comes from people who are not famous for their profligate lifestyles. At the Royal Academy in London in 1995, there was an exhibition of Tibetan art. In one of the rooms of the exhibition, four monks in their saffron robes toiled for weeks as a large and complex work of art, a sand mandala, made in intricate geometric shapes of coloured sand, guided by written instructions which they were translating from words into pattern. There was a sense of gravity, intense concentration, even reverence in the room. And the great pattern, still unfinished, had a meaning for those who could read it, and beauty for the rest. The climax of this quiet festival was to throw the whole lot into the River Thames. Waste not, want not? Yet, for the market economy, things are different. From the early years of the Industrial Revolution, society needed all its resources to invent and build its way through its difficult, touch-and-go transition, from a small-scale society depending on local economies and firewood, to a giant industrial economy depending on a correspondingly massive infrastructure of engineering, transport, complication, and regrettable necessities. As it walked this punishing route, it could not afford to discard surplus over and above the unintended waste that came with its technology. With the vast investments into which it was being forced, material want was all too evident, and it needed to use or invest all the resources it could get. At the same time, it gradually lost the reciprocities of bonding, of culture, loyalty, and place, and turned instead to the price mechanism. I will deal with you if and only if you are competitive. Otherwise, I will deal with Fred, whose prices are lower. The new market state, therefore, has not recognized surplus as a problem and destroyed it accordingly. Instead, its surplus has been conserved and valued. In fact, it has been reinvested. The modern economy has turned the problem of surplus into more surplus, to be used in turn in the production of even more at compound interest. Capital, including human capital or population, breeds capital. But a system that breaks free of constraints on its growth is the curse of an ecology. This is the sin that won't be forgiven. The resulting exponential growth postpones the necessary process of destruction, ensuring that human society loses control of its inevitable unleashing. Modern society doesn't understand surplus. It carefully conserves it, invites it in like the Trojan horse. It stores up this excess, this accursed share, ready and waiting for the crash. As Bataille comments, it causes us to undergo what we could bring about in our own way, if only we understood. What will the lean economy do about surplus? It will be built on a systems literate foundation of closed loop systems for all its primary resources. Its small scale, labour saving elegance will waste potential labour by making full-time work obsolete. Rediscovering spare time and the community building blocks that make a society, it will integrate economics again into a culture which recovers and values the gift of choice. Freed from having to produce to common, taught, competitive standards, it will instead be able to choose labor-intensive, inefficient methods. It will cultivate land as it wishes, work with whatever loving craftsmanship it knows, make music, think, sleep, cherish philosophy, control its own population, know its own culture and ecology well enough to understand the deep, ambiguous meaning of waste, and recover the intelligence of the early cultures that knew that they had to destroy, or waste, or spend on spectaculars, because their ecology and their lives depended on it. The inhabitants of the lean economy of the future could, perhaps, build cathedrals and pyramids, but there are probably enough of those. It would be better if they concentrated on being interesting. If so, they will have moved beyond the primitive ethic of competitiveness. Relations between inhabitants of these enduring and resilient lean cultures will not be reduced to their ability to compete, but enriched by their talent for surprise. A talent that will be nurtured, perhaps surprisingly, by religion.
That is chapter 9 of Surviving the Future, called Intentional Waste. And oh my, those last three paragraphs just turn everything upside down, don't they?
Yeah, and it makes me want to be there.
It really does.
Wherever that place is in the future, which is why we're here listening to this book.
Yeah, I just, and we've talked about this on occasion, both on air and off air, is we do these things the way we do them because they've always been done this way.
Right.
Right.
And yet they haven't, right? Because he brings up the potlatch and these other activities that were just as, being done that way then.
Right.
As our way is now.
Right. So seemingly to us, they've always been this way, but clearly that's not the case.
Right. Exactly. And that is the trick of culture, which again is why I love this book, because it opens up the imagination to be reminded of or exposed to the first time. It's like, oh, wait, there are other ways of being. How in the world do we get out of this trap? And, you know, one of the things I think is going to be the slogan of the 20th century sometime in the future is, you know, just because we can doesn't mean we should, because he talks about science and technology and this idea of knowledge to action, which I really like that, because it, again, just because we can doesn't mean we should. And we're in this world, this structure of culture that it says quite the opposite, that if you can, do it. And we're driving ourselves into some pretty scary ditches with that kind of thinking.
I love the idea of, to a degree, burning off the excess.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, then you become a slave to it. And
which is what we are, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, too, of the productive capacity of World War I and World War II, because of course, the Industrial Revolution, and then, you know, all these, assembly lines cranking out all this stuff. And then when the war ends, it's like, oh, now what do? We've got all this productive capacity. We have to keep these machines running somehow, as opposed to throwing away the machine that made it. I mean, that is so antithetical to anything our culture thinks. But what if we just shut those assembly lines down and so we don't need to do this anymore? But that would never happen.
Yeah. You've pointed out before that, unlimited growth can't sustain. It just can't. You just can't keep growing, right?
It's impossible. We live in a finite world. And I think more and more people are saying that out loud. But it's absurd to think that we can continually grow. And someone said once, compound interest is essentially money having sex with itself, which I think is, so it was put a little cruder than that, but it's a hilarious idea that it's just not natural. It's a strange phenomenon that is just out of control. And we live by this idea. My dad certainly has made his fortune through the secret of compound interest. But then he extends it to, obviously surplus and our, this need to have more than we need. Again, the potlatch is such a great example. Imagine Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates, like, racing each other to the bottom of what they had, my dad would do it, but he doesn't really have very much. It's all cash that he's giving away, but I think that comes from such a scarcity mentality, such a fear of, which is at the base of our brain, I think, in a lot of ways, although other cultures overcame that and recognized that there is enough and there will be enough. And if we've got too much, we need to figure out a way to get rid of it.
Yeah. Interesting, because the California wildfires have been going on and it's been front and center in the news. At the same time, my wife and I watched a documentary, I think it came out last year, called Cultural Burning. That's not the title, but it featured cultural burning by Native American tribes in the Pacific Northwest and how they're prevented from doing that these days. And they knew that they had to burn it down a little bit, you know, within their control for it to come back in a more robust, healthy way,
right?
They weren't hoarding everything to the point where, as pointed out in this chapter, the trees become so thick that the birds can't get in to the foliage to eat the worm that's eventually going to kill the forest.
Yeah, it's incredible. And that all speaks, I think, to the two words that say the most, which is right relation. The idea of being in right relation, whether you're flora, fauna, whatever you happen to be, and certainly humans. And I think Sean says a couple of times around population and density, or certainly alludes to that. And the idea that that is so much of the issue is the level of density. Because of our technology, we're able to live in ways we never could before. And that gets us out of right relation with the environment we're in. And then our whole consciousness around where we are and what's necessary there gets all screwed up. Because if you live in New York City, you're entirely dependent on the outside world for the food, for all these things coming in every day. I mean, the number of train cars that come into New York City at 4 a.m. to supply all the bodegas and all this stuff, and all the fruit's not ripe yet, so they spray it with something to speed that up. I mean, it's just all so unnatural. So we don't have this consciousness around what right relation even is.
Yeah. And the idea of being inefficient in work, you know, like they're
love
they're,
that.
Yeah. Well, there's that phrase, busy work.
Yeah.
Right.
So right.
It's just, he's just doing some busy work.
Right.
Because we have this idea that you have to be doing or making something. But the concept of, you know, busy work, you know, we were painting our living room and our dining room over the past couple of weekends. And, you know, I'm not a pro. Takes me some time to do what I could have hired out to be done a lot faster.
Right.
But it just felt so great to be doing that project with my wife.
Right. Yeah. Using your hands, getting involved, you know, and how that builds your relationship with your wife, with your son, with your house, with the place, you know, is you can't put a price on that. And again, Sean brings it back to the market economy and the fact that we're putting a price on everything. And what does that do to our relationships?
It's Surviving the Future, edited down from the writings of David Fleming's Lean Logic by Sean Chamberlain. The book is available at Rough Draft in Uptown Kingston. You can click on the link on our social media posts about the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future book club from this afternoon, and it'll take you to Chelsea Green Publishing, where you can get a copy of the book or a copy of the audio book. And I'm really compelled now to and curious to see how religion, which is chapter 10.
Very curious about that one.
Yep. Find out next Tuesday.
All right.